Welcome, friends. Want to thank John Lee Hooker and Carlos Santana for the music about change. This is Economic Update. My name is Richard Wolf. Economic Update is a weekly program about what's happening in the economic parts of our lives. The goal is to cover the most recent important events, but also to pick one or more key economic issues each week to examine in detail. Today we're going to be talking about the financialization of the U.S. and indeed the global economy over recent years. And I will be introducing in a few minutes my guest, Professor William Tabb. I'll tell you about him and we'll get right into it. The purpose of this program is now to examine an economy in trouble and undergoing change. For economic change to really benefit the majority of people in this country, we have to know more than what is happening. We need to know how our economy could and should change in ways that would better serve our needs, and this program aims to do that. I'm your host, Richard Wolf. I've been a professor of economics all my life at several universities. Currently, I teach in the graduate program for international affairs of the New School University in New York City. You can follow my economic analyses at www.rdwolf.com. I also want to thank Truthout, whose remarkable website is a courageous source of independent news and commentary daily. Check them out at truthout.org. We're interested in your questions and comments. Each week we select one or more of them. Please email your questions and comments to me again, the website www.rdwolf.com. If you're willing for us to mention your name, please let us know. Finally, please become a fan of the show on Facebook and like our Economic Update page. By following us, you will receive updates about the show and posts of relevant articles and information. You can post questions for me to answer on air there. I will either answer them there or some of them here on the radio. Okay, let's turn then to the updates that we're going to concentrate on today before we get into our interview. First is I want to talk about austerity American style. And in particular, I want to focus today on what's been happening in the states and to a lesser degree in the cities of the United States. Because when we talk about what the government is doing during this time of extreme crisis, we need to be careful because we have three levels of government whose impact on the economy is profound: the federal, the state, and the local. And by local, they mostly mean in the statistics cities. So I took up the task of being able to tell you today what's happened mostly at the state level, and I hope in the near future to talk to you about the city level as well, because most of the attention goes to the federal level. So here's the data as best I could glean it, and again, my source, for those of you that are interested in following it, is the Center for Budget and Policy Priorities, a really fine group of folks who put out a wonderful set of details about the American economy that you can pursue on your own. So here are the basic information about what has happened since the crisis officially began late in 2007. So we're dealing with the years 2008 through 2011. That's what these statistics cover. So here, let's take a look at what happened. During those years, the states suffered a drastic contraction in their revenue. That was caused not by workers' pensions or any of the other things you've probably seen in the news as being problems for states. The reason the states got into trouble over the last 4 or 5 years was simple: the economic crisis that crunched down on American capitalism. It threw millions of people out of work. It cut back production in hundreds of thousands of businesses. It led people to lose their savings or to lose their jobs or to lose their homes and consequently buy a lot less stuff. Well, unemployed people don't earn an income and so they don't pay an income tax. And a crippled economy doesn't buy as much and so the sales tax revenues of the states went down, and so it went. So there was a crunch on the states because of the economic crisis. How bad was it? Well, here's what the data show. Over the last 4.5 years, or roughly 2008, 9, 10, and 11, 4 years, states coped or tried to cope with the crunch of their revenue because of the crisis by doing two things. One you may have heard about, and that is to raise some fees and to raise some taxes to try to cope with the loss of taxes from their conventional sources because of the crisis. And they raised about $100 billion that way. But that wasn't anywhere near enough to cope with what had happened. So they also cut their spending. By how much? By $290 billion. In other words, the cut in spending by the 50 states of the United States was three times the size of the increase in taxes and fees. So they coped three-quarters of the way with this crisis by cutting their spending, and only one-quarter by raising new sorts of revenues. When the states cut their spending, what does that mean? It means they cut money on their road upkeep and on their prisons and on their school support. Many states support public schools in lots of ways. They particularly cut the budgets for colleges and universities, which in this country, the bulk of them, are the responsibility of states. When you think about it, the cuts were actually more drastic than the mere $290 billion might lead you to understand. Why? Well, let's start. Over the same four-year period that the states were cutting by a drastic $300 billion, the population of the United States increased by 10 million people. So we have states cutting back drastically while there are more people to take care of. But I'm not done. Over the same four-year period, prices in the United States rose roughly 8%. So you're cutting $290 billion, but actually the cut is worse than that because everything the government has to buy has risen in price. You really ought to add another 8% or more to the real cut to take account of what's happened to prices. You put it all together, and by my estimate, the states cut back somewhere in the neighborhood of $500 billion. That takes into account what they cut back in spending, the extra money they took from people, and the effects of the inflation. That's more than half of the total stimulus that President Obama talked to us about and got from the United States Congress. So while the federal government was spending more to stimulate, state governments in the United States were cutting back in terms of their impact on the society. One of the questions as to why the government stimulus has been so weak in helping the mass of people is because of what was done at the level of the states. The second update for today follows from the first. It has to do with students, particularly students going to public institutions of higher education. And let me remind everyone, we have roughly 15 million people in the United States who are currently attending colleges and universities. 12 million of those go to public colleges and universities. In other words, that's where most of our young people get higher education. Out of those 12 million or so, 8 million are borrowing money to go to school. And they borrow mostly through what is called the Stafford Loan Program, a program administered by the federal government to help young people go to the public schools where most of them are going to get whatever higher education they can. The Republican Party is pushing in Congress right now for the interest rates to be charged to these young people to go up in June of this year from the current rate, 3.4% a year, to double that, 6.8% a year. Let me talk for a moment with you about this. The young people going to colleges and universities are going to be the skilled workers of the future. Most economists, left, right, and center, believe that the future of the United States in a truly global economy will depend as much on the quantity and quality of the skilled young people they're producing here than on anything else. What are we doing making the cost of education twice as expensive, doubling the interest rate, for 8 out of the 12 million who are going to public institutions and borrowing money? That itself would be a problem. But I want to drive it home even more. What is the Federal Reserve currently charging banks to borrow money? The answer is less than 1%, more like 0.5%. So the Federal Reserve thinks it's important to support our economy by providing cheap loans to banks. At the same time, up the street in Washington, D.C., our elected officials are deciding that while it's important to provide cheap money for banks to help the American economy, it's not important to maintain what interest rate on students? 3.4%. And what is that in relationship to what the Fed charges banks? Over three times that amount of money. It's an interesting comparison of who's getting the benefit, who's getting the bailout, who's getting the assistance, and who isn't. President Obama has declared that he will try to hold on to the low interest rate, 3.4%, as opposed to what the Republicans are pushing for, 6.8%. But the real question is why we are not providing the support for young people that we need as a society, that they need, and that would represent dealing with this crisis by helping those in the middle and at the bottom rather than continuing to help those at the top. Before turning to our interview, my third and final update for today, and we will have more to say on these topics in the weeks ahead, was something that happened over the last week that was quite significant, I think. It had to do with the president of Argentina, Mrs. Kirchner, taking over the oil company of that society, which had begun many years ago, 100 years ago almost, as a public enterprise to find oil and to refine oil and to develop the oil business. Then Carlos Menem, a peculiar leader of that country some years ago, sold it to a Spanish company, Repsol, Spanish oil company. So what the leader of Argentina, Cristina Fernandez, decided to do was to take it back, to have the government come back and take over the oil company. For those of you that are not familiar, three other important countries in Latin America who also have oil have a government-owned company. Venezuela took it over. Mexico is a government company. And Brazil is a government company. So there's nothing unusual about Argentina doing that, but the howls went up in the press. My goodness, the government is taking over private enterprise. I just wanted to go over with you two or three things about this. One, the takeover is not a takeover without paying for it. Two newspapers I read here in the United States seem to not understand that. Of course, the Argentinian government is going to pay for it. So this is a takeover in the sense of the government saying, this must be a government enterprise, and we will buy it from the private owners. There was never a question of taking it without paying for it. Heaven forbid. So then the question becomes how much you pay for it, and that is mostly what's going on now. The Spanish company knows perfectly well that it's a done deal. It's now really only fighting in the press and making noise in order to get the best price possible out of the Argentinian government, and the people involved in this surely know that, and so you should know it too. The noise in the press is about the price, not the issue itself. And why is that? And that's because every society in the world, I believe without exception, provides in its laws just what Argentina does, that if and when the government decides that it's in the national interest for the government to take over what was before private property, it has the legal right to do that. And for anyone who's worried about it, I should explain that those laws apply here in the United States as well, and always have. We have, for example, the concept in the law of eminent domain. When a city government or a state government or the federal government believes that something that is currently privately owned is important for the social well-being of the city, the state, of the country, they have the right to come in. They're required to pay a reasonable market price, but there's no question of the legal rights of a country to make that decision. And when the leader of Argentina explained that that company had not invested in oil and gas the way they had promised to, that that company was paying out its profits in dividends rather than investing in the exploration and so forth that is wanted by this society, she provided precisely the reasons why the government felt it was in the national interest to do what it had the legal right to do and what is the legal right in all societies. That's not to argue that it's a good thing that the state takes over rather than the private. That's another matter. We'll have to see what the state does, how it relates to its workers, and how it functions in terms of that society to make a judgment. But the issue of the event should not have caused anything like the furor in the press. All right, now let's turn to our guest. I want to introduce him and welcome him to the program. He is William Tabb. And he is a economics professor, which is how I've gotten to know him over the years. His most recent book, and he's the author of quite a few, is called The Restructuring of Capitalism in Our Time, published by Columbia University Press this year, 2012. And it is the work in that book that we're mostly going to be talking about in the interview. But he also published some others, Economic Governance in the Age of Globalization, likewise published a few years ago by Columbia University Press, and a book with a lovely title, The Amoral Elephant, Globalization and the Struggle for Social Justice in the 21st Century, that was published by Monthly Review Press in 2001. For many years, he taught here in New York City at Queens College, that part of the CUNY system. He also taught at the Graduate Center maintained by CUNY, used to be on 42nd Street, now on 34th. Bill has also been a visiting scholar at Kansai University in Osaka, Japan, and a visiting professor of economics at the University of California in Berkeley. Finally, I recently learned that back in the 1970s and 80s, Bill predates me as running an economics program here on WBAI. Only in those years, it was called Behind the Economic News, not so far away from the concept of economic update, the name we came up for this program. So, Bill, thank you very much for spending some time with us today.
It's a pleasure to be back in the studio.
Okay, let's start. This term, financialization, before we go into discussing it, please, for our audience, tell us what you mean by that as a word to describe what's been happening to the capitalist economy here in the United States.
Well, two things have changed. The one we understand is globalization, and pretty much everybody has followed that. But what's been less clear is that the financial sector has taken over the economy from the productive sector. We began to see this when General Motors Acceptance Corporation, the people who gave you loans on the cars, made more money than General Motors, the people who produced the cars. And when Sears Credit Division made more money than Sears, the whole retail chain. And when General Electric, which we think of as light bulbs and refrigerators, actually made more than half their profits, most of their profits came from their financial wing. So that what we've seen over time is the financialization of companies. That is, you used to have engineers or perhaps salespeople running companies, and now what you have is the money men running them, so that most companies are led by financiers, and their incentive structure is very different than it was in the days when American capitalism actually grew much faster, because investment went back into hiring people, new products, expanding, and so on. Since the deindustrialization in the 1970s, what we've seen is companies hiring fewer people, certainly fewer people in the United States, and making most of their money on financial gimmicks, financial deals, and the compensation of the CEOs totally dependent now on stock options. And so the 4, 5, 6 years they're going to be head of the company, they want to be sure every quarter that profits go up so the stock goes up. So you don't do research and development. You don't invest. Instead, you pull money out, use it to buy your own stock. And as you buy your own stock, well, then its value goes up and you get richer. And so the short-term mentality we're seeing carries over to the whole economy. We watch groups like Bain Capital, which has been in the news recently. Its former CEO, I'm blocking on the guy's name, it's Willard something, pays less than 15% income on his $225 million wealth and his 20-odd million in income every year. How did they make money? Well, they buy companies, lay off workers, close plants, extract as much money as they can from the enterprise, borrow based on the assets of the company, and then spin it off again. The money they borrow is tax deductible. We've watched student loans, as you talked about the rising cost of going to school. Student loans, now there are more student loans than there are credit card loans in the country. And so young people come out with $25,000, $27,000 in debt, can't get jobs that pay very well, and are debtors for the rest of their lives, paying them off perhaps by the time their kids are going to get ready to go in debt, go to college, and so on. We've watched mortgages, the subprime business. We've watched collateralized debt obligations, all these things that nobody had any idea what these things were. And this, all of this together is called financialization, because it means the logic of how the economy runs is now totally different than when productive activity was driving this economy.
Well, then let me follow immediately with kind of the big question that a lot of people have. Would you say, and in your own words, that this financialization of our economy played a key or central role in producing this crisis that we're now going through? And, well, let me stop with that and get your response to that.
Yeah, no, absolutely. And it was clear that it was going to, because it's a Ponzi scheme kind of thing where it has to keep expanding. And the moment it can't expand anymore, it crashes. It's a bubble. It's a financial bubble. We've had three financial bubbles, our last three downturns, this one being the worst. Every one of them was a financial bubble. They're based on the value of houses, the value of internet stocks. There's some financial asset that goes up and up and up and up in value. And the point is to get out of it just before it crashes. And of course, all the smart people think they're going to get out the door just before it crashes. One of the bankers said when he was asked, well, you know, you can see that it's going to crash. Why are you still doing it? And he said, well, as long as the music's playing, we got to get up and dance. And what he meant by that was that unless we keep doing this, because this is how we make money, if we stop doing it, we won't make money. But the other guys will. I'll be fired. So they kept playing. Now, the mechanisms were first the subprime mortgages. That what the banks did and the other mortgage originators was they encouraged anybody who could put an X on a piece of paper to sign their name. You had guys who worked for landscape gardeners in California buying $250,000 houses. The guy earns, what, minimum wage job. Does he mind having this $250,000? Of course not. What the bank then does is it sells all these mortgages to people, many of whom they knew could never pay off the mortgage. And instead of holding the mortgage for the 30 years, bundles them up in securitized assets and sells them off to some town in Norway and promises them 6%. Well, that's more than they can get any other place. So that the corruption of Wall Street, and we have to just say straight up, the corruption, the dishonesty, the lies, the deceits that went into this had to collapse at some point. But that in the meantime, these guys made out like bandits. And when it did collapse, you, Richard Wolff, and your listeners were kind enough to give the banks their money back and to save them from suffering the consequences of the deeds they did while the rest of us did suffer. The Fed, the Treasury, the taxpayer helped so that their profits are restored.
Let me add to what you say, a personal experience. I know a number of people who work in major banks here in New York City and in hedge funds and so on, and they really can speak very poetically to what you just said. They will tell you that they knew, and even their supervisors knew, that this was an unsustainable booming upwards of these financial instruments. But as they explained, it's one thing to say, gee, everybody could see it couldn't last. It's a very different thing what they have to do Monday morning when they go into their job. They're expected to invest the money entrusted to them by their employer in such a way that it moves up more or less like other people are getting in other banks across the street. If they decide it's unsustainable and step back, they may miss out on the next week or the next month's uptick. And then when their supervisor reviews their performance compared to that of others doing similar work, they'll look like they're not making the grade.
As long as the money is there to be made, as the music is playing, you
everybody
get up
has
and dance.
To play. That's right. But it would be very, we have to understand we've organized our businesses in such a way that this craziness reproduces itself, as you say, three times for the last three bubbles that have burst and plunged this economy into a problem.
Yes, but you also have just out and out corruption and dishonesty and deceit, where the banks selling their collateralized debt obligations based on these subprime mortgages that they know will, they'll never collect on. And they sell it knowing it's not going to work. And so they work with people who are going to invest knowing it's going to lose money and then selling it for more, getting out, and everybody making money. We have the emails that say this is what we're doing. Mm-hmm. We have these stupid ads. But this was fully understood. And the point I think that you're making is the rationality of what they did. Everybody was acting in a rational way. And yet the system as a whole left the rest of us losing our homes. 4 or 5 million people have lost their homes. More will lose their homes. A quarter of the people with mortgages, their house is worth less than their mortgage, so that they'll be paying off a mortgage that's well in excess of the value of the house. People have lost their jobs. The economy is stagnating. All of this happened because of the cooperation of the government, which deregulated this, and happened under Bill Clinton. The same economist that deregulated under Bill Clinton came back to work for Mr. Obama. Obama decided he wasn't going to punish anybody for any of this. We have a system, I mean, it really is like the Occupy people say, where they will make their money off of the other 99% of us.
I want to pick up before we take our mid-program break. I want you to expand on something you said. You mentioned the extraordinary high pay packages for top financial CEOs in the major banks and hedge funds and so on. Could you broaden that out a little bit? Could you say what you see as the link between the financialization of the economic system you've described and the changing distribution of income and wealth in the United States, say, over the same period that the financialization happened, say, since the 70s?
Yeah, well, there have been two periods in American history where financiers and bankers have made a lot of money. The 1920s and then this recent period, that otherwise these jobs don't pay more than other professional jobs. It's only when they can collect the kind of rents. So that in the 1960s, the financial sector accrued about 2% of all the profits of all American companies. 1960s, 2% of all the profits. In 2004, 2006, just before the crash came, the financial sector was making 40% of all the profits of all the corporations in America. A tremendous absorption, redistribution from financialization. And so, of course, the people who were making that kind of money for their companies were being paid incredibly huge pay packages. So that if you look at who the 1% are, and at the bottom of the 1%, because you really don't get to real money to get to the top 0.1%, 0.01%, 0.001%, you know, the people way up there. If you look at who they are, yes, they're sports stars and movie actors and that kind of thing, but they're at the bottom of it. The top of that are the financiers, the hedge fund operators, the Mitt Romneys and so on. The guy who runs Blackstone, who when President Obama said, we're going to take away the low 15% tax rate you guys pay on what you call carried interest because it's really income, and we're going to charge you an income tax. He said, it's just like Hitler marching through Poland. It's that bad. I mean, you can imagine a guy who thinks like that. So that if we look at who the very, very rich people are, they are all or very heavily either financiers or people at the top of these companies.
All right. We're going to take a short break. And when we come back, we will continue our conversation with Professor William Tabb, talking about the financialization of American capitalism.
And brothers, because if you do, you can hear their voices still calling across the years, and they're all crying across the ocean, and they're crying across the land, and they will till we all come to understand. None of us are free, none of us are free. None of us are free, one of us are chained, none of us are free.
Welcome back. We are discussing the financialization of American capitalism with my guest today, Professor William Tabb. And we were just talking about, before the break, the impact of financialization on the distribution of wealth and income. My next question is for you, Bill, to tell us how you assess the role of the government's response. And I want it in two parts. What has been the effect on the government or the government's response, however you prefer, to this financialization on the one hand, and to what you've shown us about how the financialization has a lot to account for in terms of its contribution both to the crisis and to the widening gap between rich and poor? In other words, how do you assess how the government responded to all of that?
Well, the government, and I think here you're talking about Washington, but
yes,
you could say the same thing about Mayor Bloomberg here in New York, is financialization is a good thing. It creates lots of high-paying jobs and lots of other jobs that aren't high-paying. That Lower Manhattan basically exists because of the banks and the financial system. In terms of internationally, our major export is financial services. We export our collateralized debt obligations, and the dollar is the global currency. So that finance has been the growth area of the American economy. And so for them, all of this is a very good thing. And the higher the leverage goes, and leverage is a term that measures how much somebody has borrowed. So that it used to be when you bought something, you paid for it with your own money. Now you borrow money to pay for it, and then you pay that back over time. And what began to happen about 1980 was that wages in this country stagnated. The average worker was not seeing their wages go up. Many people saw their wages go down. They lost good jobs. They got less good jobs. Young people coming in started at lower wages, this so-called two-tier economy where you're doing the same job somebody else is doing, but you're getting half the money. And so to maintain their living standard, people started borrowing, and they borrowed more and more. Those who owned homes took out second mortgages so that they could have the money to buy the things to keep their standard of living up. And the government thought this was all fine because it created demand for goods and services. It kept the economy humming. And without it, growth would have slowed down and they would have been voted out of office because they would have, what are you doing? This economy's not performing. So debt is what, since the 1980s, has kept the country going. That as we import more and more from China, the Chinese very kindly lend us the money back so we can buy more stuff from China. In Europe, financialization works the same way. So in Greece and Ireland and Spain, they borrow from the banks in Northern Europe, the Germans, the Dutch, and so on. And you have a problem where the imbalance between the debtors and the creditors is such that at a certain point, again, it can't go on. The economies collapse. And the debtors are told, hey, you irresponsible debtors, this is all your fault. And the debtors say, well, but what are we going to do? And the Germans and the Dutch and the other creditors say, you're going to eat less. You're going to have less medical care. It's what we're being told by the Republicans here. So that the debt relationship creates these problems, and the governments walk into it thinking this is a great thing and end up with the disasters we have here and in other countries.
Yeah, I like to remind the listeners that a loan is a two-sided affair. A loan doesn't happen because someone wants to borrow. A loan only happens when the borrower meets the lender, and both of them have to agree on the deal. And if the deal falls apart later, the responsibility is on both sides who entered into this
relationship. No. You don't understand. It is only the debtor who pays. The creditor, and admittedly, I have to accept your argument that they've made irresponsible loans, and when you make irresponsible loans and you can't collect, well, you lose money. That's old capitalism, and I think you really have to get with it and understand modern capitalism.
There we go.
Here, as long as you can squeeze the debtor or get governments to take responsibility for the debt. In Ireland, the really corrupt government, when their banks got in trouble because of the same garbage that we have, the government said, that's okay, we'll take responsibility for all the debt. And then, of course, Ireland was, can we say screwed on BAI? We can say screwed. Okay. And so the taxpayer and the workers and people, you know, you have a new migration out of Ireland because young people and so on. So that governments, and here you have to understand democracy, and a democracy is not well understood. Democracy costs money, and that's what people forget. To run for office, you know, you want to be president, it's at least $1 billion. Now, I myself might contribute $50, $100 to someone I'd like to see president. And, well, $100 doesn't really get you much advertising on television. The head of Goldman Sachs, or
you get one pixel on the whole screen.
Yeah, it's a problem. So both presidential candidates have got to go to the same 1% to get elected. Now, you can't go to those people and then say you're going to change the system so that they don't get bailed out by the government, but they have to take their knocks when they do stupid things. You have to say, okay, we'll have the what is this tax the president wants to have named after our favorite investor?
Buffett rule.
The Buffett rule. Now, the Buffett rule is going to affect a few hundred people, and it's not going to bring in very much money. It's symbolically, however, very useful to get all the people who were upset about Obama to go and vote for him. Now, if I lived in a state where the election was going to be close, and you have to understand, it's only about 10, 12 states in the country where this election is going to be close. In New York, Obama wins by millions of votes, whatever. So for New Yorkers to spend as much time they do thinking about the election here makes no sense at all. But anyway, they will go to the people with the money, and they will have symbolic things that they will say is fairness, and if you work hard and play by the rules. We get this every 4 years, but then the system will continue to work the same way. That's the problem.
Okay. Here's a tough question, but I know it's in the minds of my listeners, partly because they've been sending me questions to this effect, but partly because it's implicit in what you've said. Do you believe that the financialization that you've described and analyzed, both with us today and in your recent book, is irreversible? In other words, do we face a kind of capitalism that represents a development that cannot, in any foreseeable future, be undone, reversed, changed?
No, but everything can be reversed. Everything can be changed. These are human choices. You know, God did not say that let there be hedge funds and buyout groups and let the 99% make straw into bricks for the pharaohs. No, that people can change history, can make their own history when they understand what's going on. And what was particularly inspiring about Occupy Wall Street is it said, we're not asking this government for anything because it's incapable of giving us what we need. And the reason it's incapable is that they work for the 1%. And this message resonated powerfully with Americans. And despite the incredible wealth that goes into trying to hide what's really going on, more and more Americans really do understand how the system works and reject the system, not just, want reforms, because the reforms won't give them what we really need. So if you follow the polls, and the polls are really interesting, more and more people, first of all, agree with Occupy Wall Street, disagree with the Tea Party, seeing them as selfish people who don't want to work for the good of the country and in a solidarity way, rebuild the country and create the jobs, build the kind of educational system. You know, when I went to City College, the country was much poorer, the city was much poorer, but I didn't pay any tuition at City College. That nobody should pay tuition to go to college. This is an investment in our future. Public transportation is an investment, gets people to work. All of the things we need to make the country better are really quite clear. The problem, of course, is that capital, this very small group of people, control the country and have the kind of government they want. I mean, it seems to me it's fairly simple. If you think it's more difficult, help me out here.
No. This is a conversation between us that we've actually had a few times just on our own, and I think I can now better understand how and why you were as successful as I know you were with your own radio program, because you speak clearly and you speak persuasively, and I think that's what I try to replicate here, but I can see I'm in the presence of an accomplished professional. Let me close out this interview by pushing you a little bit on that last point. Imagine, it's always a good kind of amusement, a little bit like buying a lottery ticket.
Well, it's a Leninist position.
Yeah, okay.
John Lennon.
Yes, right. Imagine, if you can, you're having not just a lottery ticket, but being the president or being in a position of political power. Give us some idea of where your mind would take you in terms of steps you might want to consider or present to the population for its consideration to really do something about this problem, not to make a little change around the edges, but to confront it in some basic way that would have a chance to change some of the things you've described.
Well, let's start with the premise of your question. Nobody gets to be president who's going to propose the things you're talking about. It's only when a popular movement is aware of how the system works and wants to change that system that it puts pressure on politicians, that it enables candidates of the sort that will bring about those changes, raise those issues, to run and win office. The movement comes first, and the movement has to be strong enough to impose its will on the electoral process, so that one of the great, I think, tremendous mistakes that a lot of progressive people made in 2008 was they voted for Obama and they thought, he's going to do it for us. We've won. We've succeeded. Now things will get better. But here's the guy. He's under pressure from the Senate and the House, composed of people, if they ever want to get reelected, can't go too far. If he wants to get reelected, he can't do certain things. And without the movement, for people to think that it's the president's fault or it's the politician's fault, instead of their job to build that movement that is capable of making change, that premise is wrong. Okay, having said that, what the president has to do is explain how the system works and spend most of their time using that bully pulpit to tell the truth, have press conferences, give speeches in which that person explains, and hopefully the Secret Service, when they're not too busy with hookers in Colombia, will protect them from the assassination attempts, which will come hot and heavy after that, through a media that's controlled by the 1%. You know, we talked about GE Finance. Do they still own NBC?
I think they sold it, but if they did, they sold it to someone just like themselves.
Exactly. So you have a problem where the media is not going to want to convey your message accurately. So you're going to have to directly reach the people, and that's the job. But the first thing, and I think that this is what listeners have to understand, is that the movement comes first. Building the education, the awareness of the changes we need and why we need a different system and why you're not going to get this given the 1%, 99%.
I wish we had more time, Bill, but thank you very much for coming and sharing your thoughts about financialization, its impact on the economy in so fluent and effective a way.
And you haven't re-mentioned my book, which is good for Christmas presents, birthdays, bar mitzvahs.
Okay, I will, just for that. It's called The Restructuring of Capitalism in Our Time, Columbia University Press, produced and published this year. Let me turn in our final time to some of your questions and comments. The first one goes as follows. Please comment on which of the two major political parties in the United States is more supportive of, quote, family values. I thought about this question for a while, and the answer I could come up was with this. Neither of them. I can't figure out which one I would give more or less credit to, since zero is the number I would give to both of them. So let's call it a tie. Let me explain what I mean. Over the last 30 years, and this really partly dovetails nicely with what Bill has been telling us, over the last 30 years, the real wages in the United States stayed the same. That is, if you adjust the wage workers get for an hour of work today, it's about what they got in the mid-1970s. That's an amazing thing. Over 30 years, workers became more and more productive, produced more and more for their employer, but the employer gave them about the same. For 30, an entire generation. It meant that the American dream, which was advertised to these same people every day, the desire to provide an education for your kids, to have a decent life, was becoming more and more inaccessible because your wages didn't go up to pay for these things. That was a torture of people. It created unmet expectations. It required downsizing your dreams, or you had to do the following. You had to send your wife, if you were a man, your husband, if you were a woman, out to work. There had to be two adults. And when that didn't prove to be enough, well, you had to send the retired person back into the job market. And you had to send your teenagers to work. For those of you who don't know, think a minute. The way this economy ran required more and more work out of members of a family. They all had to go out and do more and more work. They still had to maintain the household, typically the job of the women. You were putting unbelievable pressure. The OECD measures the amount of paid work per year done by different working classes in different countries. We're number one. We demand more work out of our people, and we get it. The strain that that puts on a family is staggering. And when that family, to try to cope, borrows money, then the anxiety about its debts is added to the strain of the work. Did either party confront that and do something about it? Not at all. The parties fell all over each other to reinforce the conditions that drove American families into a greater degree of disruption. Our divorce rates rose. Our dependence on legal and illegal drugs rose. The pressure of work, the pressure of debt, the pressure of a family exhausted by its workloads. All of these things were not conducive to supporting the so-called family values that politicians like to champion. I think, therefore, that the political parties have a lot to answer for in their responsibility for economic conditions that undercut families and family values. To come back and say, oh, I believe in it, then we all ought to go to church, is not a reasonable answer to what those parties supported in the way of economic policy. Here's another comment, and this time it's from Sharam Azar from Amherst, Massachusetts, as it happens, who sent in the following question. Is it true that during World War II, the United States economy was run as a planned command economy and with a pretty high growth rate? And if so, why then does mainstream economics teach us all the bad things about planning? Yes, I've always been interested in what countries do when they have what they think is an emergency. And in those moments of emergency, they deal with their economies in ways they then have a hard time explaining later. And you're right. During the period of World War II, the United States was in an emergency. It was fighting a war. It wanted to be sure not to lose that war. And it knew that, for example, it would have to devote enormous amounts of its resources to pursuing the war. Iron, steel, textiles, you name it. Now, it could have decided as a government to take what was necessary to fight the war, the resources, and to leave what was left to provide for people's consumption goods. But then it realized that that would mean a lot fewer consumption goods than there would be the demand of the Americans, because a lot of resources had to be taken away from consumer goods to produce for the war. And if only a few were left, and you allowed the market to work, well, then the prices of the few remaining consumer goods would go very much higher because they'd be relatively short supply, and the only people who could afford them would be the people with the big bucks. So the United States government intervened. It didn't feel that a market system of distribution was an effective either politically or was justifiable ethically or morally. It wouldn't do to fight a war that left the people at home without food, clothing, and shelter if they couldn't pay for it, and to provide the scarce consumer goods only to the rich. So the United States government instituted a rationing system. When I explain this to people, I often discover many Americans somehow were never told that we once had a rationing system. And here's how it worked. The government distributed tickets, they were called ration tickets or rationing tickets, to American families. And if you went to a store to buy a quart of milk, a pound of sugar, some beef, gas for your car, you had to not just have money, you had to have a ration ticket or else it was illegal to sell it to you. Wow. So the ration ticket was crucial for you to buy something. Yeah. And here comes something that may surprise you. The government distributed ration tickets according to what the government thought was a reasonable measure of people's, get ready, needs. The government distributed tickets. If you were a large family, you got more milk than if you were a small one. The government distributed to people according to their needs. You did not distribute goods, therefore, based on how much money people had, but you distributed it, at least in part, according to their needs. Likewise, the government planned lots of things. One of the people who taught me economics many years ago and who appeared on BAI fairly frequently was a man named Harry Magdoff. And Harry Magdoff was an important economist here in the United States, especially during the war period, because he was in charge of planning railroad use in the United States. The government basically told the American railroads that they would have to reorganize what they did, their schedules, their track repair, and everything, in order to fight the war. And the government was not about to buy these services. The market would be too slow, too inefficient, too prone to people weaseling out of it. So the government dictated to the railroads what would have to be done, and Harry Magdoff was a key player in that. So the answer to your question is, when the government needs something, when the economy is thought to be in trouble, many of the things we're told are inviolable, like markets and planning, end up being something governments turn to. It's a little bit like what Bill was saying to us. When the banking system collapsed, the same bankers who had been preaching to us how the government is a drag and only private enterprise works led the charge to get the government to come up with the money to bail them out. Thank you, Bill. Thank you, all you listeners. I hope you found today's program interesting, and I look forward to speaking with you again next week on Economic Update